Well, the music's finished, so it's time to get underway. I'd like you to meet my good friends, Dan and Lauren. For people who can't read from there are some handouts with the same mind map. Please acquaint yourselves with my good friends, because they're going to be our case study, our sample to help us go through the paper. So I'll just give you 30 seconds to familiarise yourself with this loving couple.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming to this session. My name's Jenny Lyon, for those of you who don't know me. I'd just like to introduce Martin Mulcair, who's presenting the session. Martin's got more than 25 years' experience in the financial services industry. The 10 years from 1995 were focused on executive financial and general management roles with Mercantile Mutual, ING, and BT/Westpac. Specific roles during that time include chief actuary, chief financial officer, and general manager, life insurance. Martin left Westpac BT at the end of 2005 to embark on a career in training, facilitation, and business advice. Martin is currently enjoying a portfolio of activities. He presents training programs for financial advisors, including coaching of new skills. He's involved in customer service training for diverse companies and presents the Business Essentials program, which helps develop so-called soft skills in management. He also acts as a business advisor to a number of companies, including one formal directorship. Martin is a fellow of the Institute, and I will hand over to him now.
Thank you, Jenny. The plan for this morning is using Dan and Lauren as a case study to highlight three or four key themes from the paper. Before we get underway, just so I've got some understanding of familiarity, can this by show of hands, how many people have read the paper? I'm not putting crosses against your name if you haven't, but I just want to know if we have basic, I need to go through this. So we've got a half a dozen. Okay, so we'll assume almost nil knowledge. And more importantly, talking about nil knowledge, I'm also interested in if we have any financial advisors, current, recent, or future in the room. Okay, so, we've got some excellent practitioners we can throw to as well. Fantastic. Let me start by highlighting what I believe the three categories of financial advisors. The first category is what I call product or situational specialists. These are people who are experts in a particular area. They may be a life insurance expert or a superannuation expert or a situation like retirement. I'm a retirement incomes expert. So the nature of their proposition to their clients is on the lines of,
hi, John, I'm Martin, I'm an expert in retirement incomes, and I can make you smart decisions. I can help you make smart decisions about your retirement plan.
It wasn't for nothing that I picked John. The second category is the investment specialist. This is someone whose proposition is all about providing you investment advice. So the style of the proposition here is, so you can see the different emphasis there. The third category is the wealth manager, people who claim they have a holistic view of a person's financial life. So the proposition there is more along the lines of helping them achieve their financial goals. So that might be enunciated along the lines of, there's a lot of people claiming to be wealth managers, but their preference, either by training or heritage, is still fundamentally, I'm fantastic at SMSFs. Oh yeah, I'll give you a plan to cover the other things, but that's their hook. The proposition is about something in their past. And we see this especially with the investment specialists. Yeah, they'll do a plan, but they're really trying to drive some alpha. In the future model, and I'm delighted that Alan Kohler gave this session such an introduction yesterday, in the model I'm proposing, it's very much around holistic. We want advisors to focus on their clients, not their clients' money. And I'd like to take the wealth manager option one step further, what I call the personal CFO. So the proposition here is subtly but effectively evolved from that of the wealth manager. It's not about the plan. The emphasis isn't on the strategy, the paper, the document I'm delivering today. The proposition is, in fact, a much more long-term one. So it will go on from, as I had delivered my proposition to Esther, it would go on to emphasise, not only will I help you make smart decisions about your money, but you will enjoy our trusted, ongoing working relationship. The emphasis is on relationship. The other subtle but important difference between the wealth manager and the principal wealth advisor, or I'm calling the personal chief financial officer, is in their role in managing the other advisors, the other experts in the client's life. So if we think of the client being the chief executive officer, the decision maker for their family, they're going to be advised for all their decisions, not just their investment decisions, not just their life insurance decisions, they're going to be advised by their principal advisor, the chief financial officer. That person won't be an expert in all the things that may happen to that client. But the CFO, just like the CFOs you're familiar with in financial institutions, will have a team of people that the CFO can call on. So the advisor doesn't need to be an expert in tax. He'll find the person with the right tax strategies. He won't need to be an expert in estate planning. He or she will know the legal firm is very good at drawing up the right wills and the right strategies. He or she won't need to be an expert in insurance. They'll have a specialist that they can rely on. They won't need to be an expert in debt, the liability side of the personal, of the client's balance sheet, the liability side. But they can find someone who's very good at debt. And for that matter, we're not just thinking about managed funds or superannuation decisions. It's all aspects of the life of the client. And so things like share broking and real estate are real options for the CFO model because, as we'll come to when we get to the pricing element, they don't need to place investments to get paid. Any questions about the concept of chief financial officer? We're doing sign language today, so shakes or nods? Okay, so this is subtle. So part of the talent of the CFO-style advisor is actually project managing all the things that need to happen to put their life in place. Let's go back to Dan and Lauren and think about what the scope of work might be if you were playing CFO, personal CFO, to Dan and Lauren. And I'm going to get Jenny to describe. So this is the audience participation part. It's not the music, you don't have to dance, not karaoke. But I'm keen to get some ideas up. What would you be doing for Dan and Lauren? And I don't mean detail. Think of this as the headings or the subheadings in their plan, in their strategy document, especially for some practitioners. Murray Lees.
Actually, I just wanted to just jump back to the previous slide.
Yes.
Legal
is certainly one of the experts we'd use. I've had it under estate planning, but there'd probably be lots of other aspects of legal we'd require.
So you actually see that within your scope?
If I'm playing personal CFO for my client and something requires legal advice, I would ensure that the right legal advice was being sought, given, and I'm putting them on to an expert that I have trust in. Precisely, and that analogy is in the paper. Very good. Very good. Thank you. No, that's okay. I'm sorry. I hope my tone wasn't dismissive there. I respect the busy lives we have, and I wouldn't expect people to read the paper. Okay, so over to you. Over to you. This is the audience participation part. What are some of the headings that would be in the strategy plan? Let's start with some simple things. What might we be doing? Okay. All right, so we've got two young children, twins. And it's likely that Dan and Lauren haven't revisited insurance for some time. Very good. What else? Small business issues. Okay, and some subheadings under small business issues?
Tax.
Okay, so and it's right, the accountant may or may not be doing a good job with tax, so we'd work with the accountant to ensure that the tax planning there for the business is aligned with the tax planning as an individual. Perfect. Okay. Future tax planning. One of Dan's goals is to sell the business within 10 years to realise the equity. So as Murray Lees has identified, then one of the things we need to look at is what do we need to start putting in place now for that in terms of tax and other things. Okay. Other subheadings.
Funding retirement.
Okay, so funding retirement. We can see that there is a super fund. Lauren will have some as well. And rethinking the shape of that, checking at least doing some diagnostic on it would be very good. Okay, what else?
Estate plan.
Okay, excellent. Well, we've got this the complexity of previous marriage, son from previous marriage, and so estate planning, ensuring that the wills will deliver what Dan and Lauren want. And Dan thinks his ex-wife is a dragon, right? He's very happy to look after Michael, but he doesn't want the dragon's new children getting a share. So how would we make sure that the wills are drawn up to ensure that Michael gets the benefit, not those new kids that might turn up?
Structures.
Okay, family trust. So this aspect of estate planning, it's not just the wills, but it also moves into broader areas. The ownership of the company, asset protection, trust structures to ensure that if this engineering firm goes down, it doesn't take all of the family's wealth with it. So making sure we've got the right structures in place. What else might we be interested in? Great. Dan's really worried about Sylvia. She's 77, getting older, starting to look a bit frail. So what are the sorts of options that we want to give Dan and Lauren for that? And this isn't an objective thing. This is having a very serious conversation with Dan and Lauren about the relationship with the mother, or the mother-in-law in this case, about their wishes, their goals in that regard. What are their values? Is this a couple having mother living with them is key to their family goals, or is this the last thing they'd think about? So exploring that would be important. Very good. Okay, so yeah, some of the standard stuff that the investment specialists would focus on. We've got this share portfolio, may or may not be well chosen. We'd have a look at that. We'd also have a look at the asset allocation in regard to where the super fund aspects are, the whole question. Very good.
Charitable giving.
All right, so he's expressed some interest in charitable giving. So let's explore what form that philanthropy might take. All right, so he's got some ambitions to send the children to private schools. So some funding for that. What's going to be the impact on cash flow? How might we fund that? Very good. That's a fantastic one to pick up. So realising the equity in this small business isn't necessarily going to be a one-off sale. It may be, as pointed out, that some good quality succession planning to the existing team, a gradual handover of equity, and some advice and guidance in that regard from far more valuable handover may be the answer. And you can see why the product specialists and investment specialists wouldn't be thinking in such broad terms. Anything else?
Work-life balance?
Yeah, okay. So one of the things that Dan is struggling with is time. Doesn't have time to think about these financials. And he's still concerned, given his ambitions. He is looking to retire early. So what are some of these goals and values that we can reflect in the plan? And work-life balance might be one of them. Anything else?
Tax optimization.
So tax optimization, both in terms of business, the family. Exactly. And we'd go and get some advice on that. Sure. Yep, and the same things, yep. And what about this holiday house? They may have an emotional attachment to it, but in the broader sense of investments, assets, allocation, you may have to question that. And maybe there'll be a point where a real heart-to-heart conversation with these guys. You've got an underperforming asset. You only go up there every second weekend. The time you use it is Christmas holidays when the rental could be maximised. And in fact, given that Jessica and Jordan have got activities on Saturday mornings and even more of them, you're not even going to get to that weekender. Let's rethink. Is this a smart investment? Well, after all, with Jordan playing soccer and Jessica doing ballet, probably this day and age, it's Jessica playing soccer and Jordan doing ballet, but you know those sort of commitments and understanding the relationships, their values, is core to any kind of advice that we'd be given. Right. So it gives you an idea of scope. So there's a lot more there than what would be evident if the superannuation expert was focusing on that part of the draw, the investment expert focusing on that part of the draw, and especially, rubbing hands together, $1.5 million coming in. Right. Quite a different focus.
Sorry, it doesn't say it's a
self-managed ship. I know, it doesn't. No. He's an engineer, he can't remember all that stuff. Yeah. This comes from the first meeting, so it wouldn't. But the key element differentiating his personal CFO is the relationship with these things. He won't hand this over. He won't assume that the accountant is doing a good job. There'll be a sit-down conversation with the accountant and what he or she is doing with Dan. Right? There'll be a conversation with the lawyer about the estate. There'll be a conversation with the insurance broker around not just the life insurance, but the general insurance arrangements for Dan, both as a business owner and in terms of their property. The weekender, he hasn't even thought about house and contents insurance for the weekender. What happens if someone breaks in? Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, so you've got some understanding, and I use the term in the paper, clients with complexity. And it may not be complexity in the advisor's mind, because the advisor's used to seeing people like that, but mapping out all the aspects of the life of Dan and Lauren makes it clear to them that, yeah, they've got some complexity in their lives and the CFO is going to take away that stress, that time, that worry, and is going to deliver, right, an ongoing relationship with a focus on the values of Dan and Lauren, financial security for the family, financial security for Michael and his mother-in-law, and some of these longer-term goals about early retirement, the freedom to go sailing, etc. Right? So this is a sort of role. So we're understanding of scope. Let's move on to the tricky issue of pricing. I had to put Benji Marshall in there. He was back in business on the weekend, two tries. For the Melbourne people, don't worry. So the difference between advisors as price takers versus price makers. The heritage of the industry has been to see advisors primarily as intermediaries. I mean, that's the heritage of the agents, right? That they worked for the company and they were distributing the product. So not surprising, the heritage is to build in the margin into the product. That makes sense? What I'm challenging is whether that has to be the case. And in fact, while advisors are relying solely on the margin that's in the product, then, as Alan Kohler said enthusiastically yesterday, there are consequences of that, implications for conflicts. If Lauren wants to honour the memory of her parents and invest in real estate, the traditional advisor who sees investments as the margin, as their income, is not going to be that interested in real estate because there's no margin there. There'd be a strong, strong temptation to explain to her the wonders of going into a managed fund. So it's not just the price taking in terms of being subject to the pricing of the institutions, but also the implications on potential conflicts. So we want the advisors in the new model, the personal CFO, to be pricing in the meeting with the lawyer, the meeting with the insurance broker, God knows how many meetings with the accountant. Right? There's no, traditionally, is that a FUM thing? Is that a percentage of assets under management? The CFO style needs to be factoring in that type of activity. Right? Otherwise, just doing work for nothing and thinking that that there will be income solely from implementation of the asset recommendations is contrary to the proposition. And what's my proposition? I'm going to be with you for a long time. We're going to ensure that all those goals are established over time. And some of those things on the list, they're today things, but some of them are next year, 3 year type things. So we're mapping that out and bringing them to bear as we go. And of course, a whole range of those don't have a traditional margin associated with them. So it's fundamental that in the new model, that the advisor builds some pricing muscles to become a price maker and get away from a dependence on the margin in the products. So what form might that take? Here's one way of thinking about the way that a personal CFO style, a principal wealth advisor, might think about the price. For John to have the pleasure of working with me as an advisor, there's a certain base retainer, right, that I would be charging John for looking after him, just being aware of his existence, for having the relationship. There's a retainer down the bottom just for the relationship. You know, a minimum fee style. It's equivalent of membership paid for the golf club. Whether or not you turn up and play, there's a certain fee being that is being paid. And that's being used to mow the fairways, cut the greens, keep things in shape. John isn't going to ring up the golf club every now and then just check if he has a 17th green coming along, right? Any more than he's going to be ringing the advisor to find out, you know, what have you been doing for me this week? Right? There's a certain element of just the peace of mind knowing that someone is looking after you that is our base point. The middle part of the triangle, the services component, this is where the fee would become variable. So in Dan and Lauren's case, how much is actually going to get implemented this year around the life insurance activity, the estate planning, the tax, the business succession, how much of that happens will determine how much that I, as advisor, am going to charge Dan and Lauren. And then the part at the top will be, well, what's happening from a project management point of view? And that's going to be variable. For some clients, it'll be nil. There aren't that many advisors I need to fit in with. There isn't that much project management required. But in this case, with the existing advisors and some of the projects we need to get underway, like the business succession planning, then me acting as go-between with the business succession expert, the lawyers, the estate planners, this will require some time. So thinking about, well, what's an appropriate fee to charge and putting that into the quote. So this would be the process. We've got, from a lengthy discovery meeting, focusing on the values and goals of the client firstly, before we even ask about incomes and assets, and then coming back to them with a proposal. This is your financial world. These are your values. This is what I heard you say was most important to you. And if I'm going to deliver that, these are the things that need to happen this year. And the price for that will be X to Y, a range of for the first year. So it's the style of the pricing. Right? It's not $1,000 for the plan, a couple of $1,000 implementation, and it'll be some bips on the assets. Right? It may deliver a similar number, but you'll appreciate that the transparency and the pricing muscles required, right, is quite a different exercise for the business, for the advisor thinking as a business person, thinking about how to come up with an appropriate fee. Your turn again. If my beautiful assistant could move on the page. I'm interested in what your perceptions of an appropriate fee might be. There are no right answers, and there are certainly no wrong answers. I'm just interested in terms of perceptions. If my proposal to Lauren and Dan had set out the things that Jenny listed there, that was the scope of work, what would I be charging Dan and Lauren for this year? To the nearest $5,000.
Million.
Okay, so the total revenue to the advisor in year one for you was about $10,000
plus. Plus there's an ongoing $1,500, yep. But it's offset against basis
okay.
Points.
So it might be okay. So there's one starting point from actual experience. Oh, you got yourself a bargain, Melinda. Especially the premium they added for dealing with you. So that's great. Yeah, okay, so it's a starting point. Some other suggestions, notions. What might a CFO ask Dan and Lauren to pay?
I was going to say 10, but it wasn't
that good. Okay, so another 10 to 15. Other thoughts, Marilis? You had 10?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And you would add, and that's just for you, clearly the cost of the lawyer, the accountant will be on top of that again. Yeah, so this is just revenue to your business.
Say,
and Ken's point is a very important one, that in identifying an ideal client, are these people who are prepared to delegate to you, are prepared to hand over the reins in the financial life? And if they're not, if they won't take advice, then it's next. Most powerful word in client selection? Next.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. All right, look, there's said no right answer. And someone who's early days with this, only developing their pricing muscles, $10,000 may still have our palms sweaty, and it may be about right. I'd actually think that for that, I would think somewhere in the range of 20 to 25 would be more appropriate. Now, let's forget about collection or timing of that, right? But over the full year, I would think something in the order of 20 to 25.
Yeah, I should say I had to do all the liaising with the experts, so mm-hmm. that extra labour okay. wasn't there, so I did some stuff.
Okay. Now, would Jan and Lauren think that was a good number? I don't know. And just as the people here will have a very different reaction. If you were quoted $10,000 for taking away the complexity of your financial life, as Melinda was, you may have a heart attack, And you may say, no, I'm sorry, that's too expensive. I'll handle it. I've got some expertise. Or it may be, some of you go, if that's going to save me all the time, effort and harassment from my partner, then yeah, $10,000. Where do I sign? And that's the thing. It's a decision for the client. But it's who's determining the price? The advisor's determining the price. After that, the ball is in the court of the client. Now, I should acknowledge at this point we're talking about pricing and the concept of value and what they might be prepared to pay. Richard Cornwell was inadvertently the catalyst for this paper. He presented a paper 2 years ago on the value of financial advice. And like a good actuary, he came to some very specific ways of measuring value. And it boiled down to some of the investment advice and the value of an appropriate asset allocation, which is very appropriate. You know, we're trained to think about tangibles. But in that scenario, what is peace of mind worth if we have a widow as a client who doesn't even know whether she can afford to go on holiday with her friends in 6 months' time? Then what is peace of mind worth to her? And so this whole sense of pricing, getting away from bibs, and this isn't about gouging, but you know, what is an appropriate fee for taking away the worry is a tough question. Chair, should we be taking them now? While we, of course. We're about to throw to questions. I just want to, I'll get you to use the mic. I'll be good from now on because it will be recorded. So, the wrap up was, this is all very interesting, right? Dan and Lauren, fascinating people. Looking forward to meeting them. Although he's an engineer, he's pretty dull, really. But the implications. You know, why did I write this paper? The first is so you get some appreciation, given a number of you are in institutions where you deal with the distribution arm, then what the implications might be for financial advisors who actually consciously decide to adopt a model like this. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult about conveying, communicating a different proposition. It's very difficult about the pricing and the pitching of that. It's difficult when you think about the implications on their business. They're so used to having a floor of X times renewal income, i.e. trails, that taking that away is a scary thought. So there are some serious implications for the advisors. Some implications for the clients. The sense of being long-term. The sense, though, of actually being valued as individuals, focus on the client, not the client's money. For actuaries, I saw two different implications. One is for actuaries in product design roles. Now, I know there are some steps have been made. I think Nicolette pointed that out yesterday morning to challenge Alan, that variability around dialing down of investment products, especially in terms of upfront fees, is there. But how much of that is actually happening in terms of trails, I'd probably still challenge. So, you know, what is it about product design? Will we make it easier for this type of model? And I think the real test would be if you took away entirely commission from a life insurance product, that would be an interesting pricing proposition. And in the hands of the personal CFO, being able to say, I will look after all your insurance decisions as part of my security proposition for your family, and here's this product, or someone else is providing the product, and not taking the commission, it would be fascinating to see how much cheaper the actual product would be. So think about it as product designers. Next time you're building in what Andrew Gale described yesterday as the margin for distribution, is whether me as personal CFO, whether I actually need you to do that for me. No thanks. I don't need you to put the margin in there. I'll look after it very nicely. Thank you. The second aspect was I have full confidence in the financial skills of the people here. But whether you want to apply that to your own life with all the time, effort required, is again a choice that you will need to make. If you choose to delegate, then I suggest you need to be a bit fussier about who's going to be providing financial advice for you, and whether you're just interested in getting some alpha or a plan, or whether you actually do want someone that's going to take an interest in you as an individual. And I think probably for people here, that's probably only about maybe 20% of the people here might choose to get some advice. And the other 80% more than happy to look after that. But it gives you a different perception, perhaps, of financial advisors or a small minority of financial advisors rather than your preconceived ideas of them being product floggers or transaction experts.
Thank you, Martin. So I'll just open up for questions now. If you could use a microphone and state your name before speaking, please. Thank you. Melinda?
Now, you've got to be disciplined now. We let you off by just talking from the chair, but you have to go to the microphone now.
We've got about 25 minutes.
Oh, so. Splendid. Great question. Let me do two parts. One of the implications for the advisors about having to get rid of the tail, but the specific question about scope of the for the population. I deal with the second one first. There's a really rough estimate in the paper. It's very difficult to assess because this isn't about quantity of assets. So it's not something we can just look at the numbers in the ABS survey. I've done that as a proxy for complexity. But really, it is about the complexity in their life. If this is a set and forget, if it can just be managed from a... Thank you. If this is something that can be dealt with quite simply, then an old-fashioned model is going to be more effective. Why spend all that time to understand the values and goals and go into deep if all they really want is some advice on their superannuation? And this is where I think that this is still a minority model, right? But I suspect it's somewhere in the order of 30,000 to 50,000 households in Australia would be applicable for. And it's better to have those people targeted there and leave the people that have got relatively simple needs to organisations that have got a business model which is about efficiency. If we've got 300 Westpac planners that have got fantastic templates, nice, efficient systems, and a very, very good mentality around pipeline, well, as Alan Cole suggested there, if all you're after is an upgrade of your life insurance, go and see them and they'll fix it, and hopefully quickly, efficiently and inexpensively. And at the moment, as Alan pointed out, having to go through all of the compliance steps makes that an expensive process when it should be as well. So I see this being a minority of advisors catering to the people with complexity in their lives, and for many that will be asset related, but not necessarily. And I'd like to think by having some separation of the compliance rules to allow depth in advice for people with complexity like Dan and Lauren, and much more efficient product-specific advice for the people that are only after the simple solutions would be one way of doing it. So that was the second point. The first point, one of the consequences for the financial advisors, if they're going to deal with people with this complexity, in fact, if they enjoy working with those sorts of challenges, then are they going to be satisfied going back to juggling the age pension and retirement income type question? And for most of them, once they decide to go, if I can use the term, upmarket, then there are consequences for business. They do have to start saying no to some of the traditional clients because they're not going to enjoy working with them. Now, the alternative is pass it on to the junior advisors. But for people familiar with Gen Y, they're impatient about their careers. They don't want to wait 10 years before they get to work with Dan and Lauren. They want to have a piece of that sort of action now. And so if the plan was, I just go, we keep the old clients coming in the door and the young people will cut their teeth on them, the young people aren't going to be satisfied with that. So there are some consequences around changing the business model away from that. So it does require some deliberate repositioning of the firm, as was your experience.
Do you want to go next, Chris?
Yeah, it's an excellent observation and neatly outlines some of the challenges that the advisors have. Firstly, some of their sales and relationship skills are very important in the early days in terms of positioning themselves effectively, understanding the clients, and ultimately selling the fee. Some of those skills are helpful. But you're right, that transition to a consultative model is a tricky one. And for some, then identifying the challenge and using some of the other skills is one way of augmenting it. So it's certainly one of the challenges. And the other one is, and to Chris's term, anchoring. What is the basis for those fees and the pricing models. And we don't want to go necessarily to a pure hourly rate. I mean, the accountants send themselves crazy just to the tune of, how do I get more income? By working longer hours. Oh, fantastic. And you can imagine how attractive that model is for Gen Ys coming through. So I don't think hourly rate as a basis is the answer. But working out cost as a profit testing model for the fee is going to be important, because you want to make sure that if the $10,000 that's being charged actually does turn out to be profitable for the firm. So some testing of what work was involved to look after Melinda and ensure that Guest McLeod continued to make a profit should happen. So it is complex, but for many it's as simple as, well, what is your business plan for next year? What revenue does your firm need for the two advisors and four support staff? We need revenue of $600,000. Well, okay, that sounds very much like 60 clients at $10,000 each. And so that's the sort of basis before we start working about hours. Then later, we've got one about $10,000 clients. Okay, let's do some timesheets for a while to see whether we can deliver that effectively for $10,000. Sure, we should have been charging that person $20. She's so difficult. So it's it is difficult. And I'm not underestimating some of the challenges. And I think the larger the organisation, the more difficult to turn it around. And most of the people I've worked with have been younger than me, and being able to rethink business models, especially if they've only got to drag two or three other people with them rather than 23 people with them. Good observation. Thank you, Chris. Ken? Oh, sorry, you're in charge. Yeah. Good observation. I'm glad Ken did the sums because I didn't have a calculator with me. But, yeah, that's what we're talking about. And this is why at 20,000 to 40,000 households in Australia that may be happy to have this proposition, there's still quite a bit of work for quite a few advisors at 20 clients per person.
There's 20 new clients, really, in here, because you can service the existing
correct.
Ones.
Correct. Correct. Can I just pick up that one? Another serious implication is about role interacting with the other advisors. And it may be that where there is a long-standing accountant, using a term like personal CFO is probably unnecessarily provocative. And even aiming in a conversation with the accountant, so I'm taking over here, is unnecessarily provocative. Ultimately, the client will make the decision of who their first phone call is to when they're thinking about their next property purchase, whether they talk to their accountant first or they talk to the advisor. And this is, as Marley says, going to be a function of how effectively that trust is built. Excellent observation, the last one. Yeah, noted in the paper the consequences for business valuation. There are some assumptions there as how long that might continue, and if Alan Cole gets his way, of course, that will be curtailed at some point. The other way of thinking, though, is if Riley's point about one person, this is not an effective model for a single person, because it's just so dependent on one person. And the value of the business being dependent on one person means it's going to be nil. But if we've got a composition of three advisors, six support staff, and we've got the ongoing income reflected in a very healthy P&L, then a more normal valuation method, looking at the profitability of the business, applying suitable multiple, taking into account how dependent it is on the person, there is an alternative. So it certainly is a challenge, but it is not insurmountable, especially if some appropriate business succession actually happens. So instead of just being trying to sell the business tomorrow, that over 5 years, bringing some people in, gradually releasing equity and maintaining focus on profitability of the business and being able to focus on ensuring it's not too key person dependent, then it can be done. But, we shouldn't underestimate the difficulty.
Anybody else?
Noting the difficulties, especially expressed by someone who's tried to do it. Yes, of course. Mind you, not exactly a great proposition. My most profitable clients are the ones I don't do anything for. Interesting.
Okay, you've got it, but
Yeah, if you have one or two new clients per month, each paying $20,000 to $25,000, and you've got some that are saying $5,000 to $10,000 for the pleasure of you looking after the golf course, then $500,000 without my calculator is doable. I've got, you know, show you figures. Yeah, but and again, what are most businesses at their healthiest are generating revenue. And what are new people going to join? They're going to join thriving businesses that have got new clients. So we don't think about it being such a static model about get the clients and then that's it. The whole idea is to ensure that this is a vibrant business with the appropriate, using Chris's term, sales and marketing to ensure that there is, in fact, that that stream of quality clients. Well, it's a great observation. This isn't set and forget. This isn't the plan for Dan and Lauren. Right? We've mapped out the issues and what's going to happen next year. Oh, we haven't needed to do anything about Sylvia. You know, 2 years' time, right? She actually, her health has deteriorated. We now need to do something. Oh, don't worry about Jordan. You know, we'll worry about the school later. You know, 3 years' time. Okay, let's revisit that conversation. Now, we love the holiday house, right? Well, off the table for now. 4 years' time, let's have a conversation about the holiday house. Maybe this is an appropriate time to be selling. I mean, how many times did you get there last year? What was your rental income? So, and this is before we even talk about other things that might happen to Dan and Lauren. Divorce stats, second marriage, you know. So, you know, that all these things, and you know, issues with the company. Changes to other aspects, you know, when Michael gets 21. So it is a dynamic, and this is quite a different proposition compared to looking after people at retirement age. Life will continue to happen to Dan and Lauren. That's correct, and that was the approach that Marie-Lise was adopting. We're setting out the roadmap now. Right. And then how we execute that, this is where some of the project management skills come in, as well as the client's trust, support, and timing.
But you're not going to keep that unless you are actually maintaining.
Well, and this is the growth challenge. Where are you going to get the right people to continue to look after, to foster these trusted quality relationships? So yeah, good point. Yeah. Absolutely, and this is part of the proposition that we need to be conscious that there is only a limited number of clients, and if the number is 20, or for most people I work with, the number is 50, then they need to be disciplined about that, and that may be the agreement, especially if this is one of your concerns, because I'm having a fairly detailed conversation with you about your concerns, your past experience with advisors, then that's my commitment to you, Bruce, you know, would be, if number of clients is a concern, my commitment to you is I won't look after any more than 30 people like yourself, and I believe that I can do that. And if you don't feel like you're getting that type of personal treatment that I've been promising, let me know. And therefore, my challenge then is how do I build the business and get the right people in for the next 30 clients? So, yeah, absolutely. There is a flaw in the proposition if I just keep taking more people on. There's more clients on. Yeah, but you're right. You don't want to get taken for granted and be treated like the last advisor, as Bruce was warning. Yeah.
Do we have one last question, comment? Yeah.
Excellent question, Andrew. Clearly, the people with some complexity in their lives may well be customers of the private bank. Some of the people I'm working with are actually in private banks to improve their proposition. I think the history has shown, though, that private banks are run by bank people. What do bank people think about? Yeah, right. They're big on transactions and lending transactions. So they're very good at getting the people in, but unless they are very good at recognising the relationship skills of someone else in the business, they're not as going to be as effective as some of the smaller boutiques that have got some very effective targeting and positioning with some key niches. But excellent observation. In theory, they should be very effective at implementing this. But in practice, the wrong people are driving those cultures. There are some exceptions. There are some exceptions, and I've certainly come across a few.
Do you want to make any final comments?
Finally, I should acknowledge a couple of people. I mentioned Richard already for inadvertently providing a catalyst for the paper. Jim Stackpool, non-actuary, who provided a number of the ideas and principles, and Jeff Austin, who's had some experience in running distribution, was my peer reviewer, and he had a lot of very helpful input, and he was an apology for the session, so I should acknowledge those. It's great to have, I didn't realise that Melinda was going to be here to get a client perspective. I just want to wrap up. Dan and Lauren are made up, but for the purposes of this and other demonstrations, but this is a legit testimonial from someone I work with. So this was a letter sent by one of the clients. Despite the fact that I think I am intelligent, my behaviour and reflexes financially are frankly not smart. I said to Tara that I want her to take over and tell me what to do. I've been hospitalised frequently over the last 3 months, and having Tara's help to do things that otherwise, locked in my hospital bed, would have been impossible to address has really been a benefit. I've always wanted my accountant to give me this sort of guidance, and he has always explained that this was not his role, to my great frustration. I've sought financial planning advice before and found nothing other than fee-driven activity pushing investments and no one cares about the rest of my financial management. My experience with Tara has been the exact opposite. So there are some good experiences out there. Thank you very much for your active participation today and I hope you do get a chance to have a look at the paper, and best wishes with your own financial advice.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you all for your contribution. Thanks to Martin for his time.